Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners. Smith v. Houston.
May it please the court. Mr. Brett Ryan and Ms. Kathy Fisk will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Ryan will open with the first 12 minutes. I'll go through the rebuttal.
My name is Brent Ryan. I represent petitioners Philip Smith Sr., the Philip Smith Sr. family, and Mike Jackson. This cause is an appeal of an administrative agency decision brought pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act. Houston Chemical Services, Incorporated, or HCS, filed an application with the Texas Water Commission seeking a permit to construct and operate a facility to store and incinerate hazardous waste. After 68 days of hearing, resulting in over 10,000 pages of an administrative record, the Commission's hearings examiner recommended denial of the permit based on 7 separate grounds. However, the Commission proceeded to issue the permit. Harris County and my clients, the Smiths and Mike Jackson, then sought judicial review. Judge Williams in Travis County District Court and then the Austin Court of Appeals have upheld the Commission's decision. I plan to first address points of error concerning liability insurance, then points of error concerning commission rules regarding evaluation of air emissions. Ms. Sisk will then address Harris County's point of error regarding the commission's confession of 38 points of error as presented in the district court. By way of points of error 19 and 20, we have challenged the 2 provisions in the commission's final order that relate to liability insurance requirements. In the green handout that we provided, behind tab 4 are the relevant statutory and regulatory provisions regarding liability insurance. We contend that the $1 million, $2 million minimum insurance requirements set out in the rule at the bottom of this page can be used only if the evidence shows that those amounts are sufficient based on the statutory criteria at the top of the page, which are the degree and duration of risk. The Commission, as shown by finding of fact 30 in its final order, and the Court of Appeals, both concluded that the regulatory minimums are all that is required without any showing of support. We further believe the finding of fact and conclusion of Law 19, which states that HCS's proposal to have $1 million, $2 million in liability insurance satisfies the requirements, are not supported by substantial evidence, are actually supported by no evidence, and in fact are contrary to the only evidence in this administrative record regarding liability insurance. This is the testimony of HCS's financial expert, Lori Lewis, who initially testified that investors in the project would require that the project have $10 to $20 million in liability insurance. She subsequently changed her testimony to lower that figure to $5 to $10 million. When asked the basis of the $5 to $10 million figure, Ms. Lewis testified that it was based on the risk associated with incineration. The Court of Appeals didn't address this evidence at all. Houston Chemical Services suggests that Ms. Lewis's testimony should be ignored and claims that the Commission's permit engineer, Randy Banky, testified that HCS's proposal meets the liability insurance requirements. We believe that HCS has misstated Mr. Banky's testimony. In the testimony relied on by HCS, Mr. Banky simply testified that HCS's permit application includes the statement that liability insurance coverage would be as required by the rule. Mr. Banky clearly never testified to the adequacy of the amounts proposed by HCS. In fact, when Mr. Banky was specifically asked if he were prepared to offer an opinion as to whether what HCS proposed met the minimum requirements for liability insurance, Mr. Banky testified, quote, no opinion of that sort. We submit that the Commission's finding of fact and conclusion of law regarding liability insurance are contrary to the law and, in fact, are contrary to the only evidence in this record regarding the issue of liability insurance and risk. We have raised 13 points of error, points 2 through 14, regarding the evaluation of air emissions in this case. At the district court, the commission admitted error in connection with 8 of these 13 points. Primarily, we contend that the commission failed to follow its mandatory rule regarding evaluation of air emissions. In the green handout behind tab 2 are the relevant statutory provisions regarding air emissions. The provision at the top of the page is the Texas Clean Air Act's general prohibition on causing or contributing to air pollution. The second statutory provision on this page is the statutory definition of air pollution, which is the presence in the atmosphere of air contaminants in such concentration and of such duration that they may tend to adversely affect human health and the environment. So the statutory definition of air pollution relates to two things, the concentration of the contaminants and the duration of their presence in the atmosphere. The statutory provision at the bottom of the page directs the Commission and the Texas Air Control Board to adopt joint rules setting out criteria to be used by the Commission in permitting hazardous waste facilities. Behind tab 3 in the green handout is one of those joint rules. This is the Commission's rule 367A. Subsection 2 of that rule starts off by saying that the owner of the facility must demonstrate that the facility will not result in air pollution. Simply a restatement of the prohibition in the Clean Air Act. The rule then goes on to specify how that demonstration must be made. And I want to explain the methodology described in that rule by referring to the diagram behind tab 1 in the handout, which is the same as the chart on the easel up here. This is the diagram of the incineration system HCS has proposed. HCS plans to use two incinerators, shown in orange and red on the diagram, followed by various pieces of pollution control equipment, which are shown in blue. The first incinerator, a rotary kiln, would be what is called the primary combustion chamber, because that's where the waste is fed into the system and where it initially starts burning. The waste then goes into a fluidized bed incinerator, which is what's referred to as the secondary combustion chamber, where burning is completed. The air contaminants and gases are then routed through five separate pieces of pollution control equipment. The idea behind this system is that the burning, which starts in the primary combustion chamber and is completed in the secondary combustion chamber, will destroy most of the harmful organic material in the waste. And the pollution control equipment, the five blue devices, would then remove most of the remaining air contaminants before the gas stream is emitted to the atmosphere through the main stack shown at the far right-hand side. Rule 367A2 says that emissions from a hazardous waste facility must be evaluated using three things. First, waste characteristics. In other words, what's going into the system, what's being fed in. Secondly, emissions estimates. In other words, what's coming out. At the main stack, the emissions estimates deal with the air contaminants that are left after the burning and pollution control processes are completed. The third element that the rule says has to be used is dispersion modeling. That involves the use of computers to predict how much of the air contaminants that remain will actually reach the ground and may affect people in the environment. In terms of the definition of air pollution from the Clean Air Act then, the dispersion modeling gives us the concentration of the air contaminants, how much is going to be there. The other component of air pollution in the Clean Air Act definition is duration. The computer models that are used to do the dispersion modeling use two different time frames. Acute health effects are evaluated based on the maximum exposure that can occur in a 30-minute period. Chronic health effects are based on average exposure over a period of a year. This methodology that I've just described, use of waste characteristics, emissions estimates, and dispersion modeling, was the primary focus of the 68 days of this hearing. There were 28 witnesses who testified. 20 of them testified about one or more aspects of this methodology used to evaluate air emissions. At the hearing and in HCS's permit application, 23 different sources of emissions at the proposed facility were evaluated using this methodology. They included not only the main stack that's shown here, but air emissions from a truck wash area they're proposing to build, even dust from paved roads kicked up by trucks driving over that road. They were all evaluated using the same process. There's one important source of air emissions that was not evaluated this way. That is the heat surge vent or dump stack on the rotary kiln, which is shown on the right-hand side of the rotary kiln incinerator on the diagram. Now remember, at this end of the rotary kiln, what we have is partly burned waste and gases that haven't been through any pollution control equipment. It is undisputed that there were never any emissions estimates or dispersion modeling done for emissions from this heat surge vent. Two of the three parts of the methodology required by the rule were not used. What about evaluation of these emissions in terms of the statutory definition of air pollution, duration, and concentration of air contaminants? It's undisputed that when the heat surge vent opens, it will release emissions for 15 to 30 minutes. And since 30 minutes is the entire period of concern for evaluating acute health effects, the duration of these emissions is clearly significant.
In what, terms, how is it determined when that vent would be open?
There are provisions in the permit application and in the permit which identify the conditions under which HCS would be allowed to open that vent and release the material from there. Primarily, it relates to a buildup of pressure inside the rotary kiln. When that happens, several things can happen. Either the hot gases and the waste that are in there at that time can blow out the end of the kiln, possibly harming workers at the facility. They can continue to blow all the way through the system, possibly harming some of the pollution control equipment.
Well, is there any projection how often that might occur?
No, ma'am, other than there is some evidence that it's not anticipated to happen very frequently.
Very frequently?
It's not expected to happen very frequently.
But I mean, that's good.
It's not likely to occur. It is, I think the testimony is clear that it is anticipated to be a low frequency occurrence. But our position is that when you have the statutory concepts of duration and concentration, you can't substitute frequency and say, well, if it's not going to happen very often, then we don't really care what's going to come out of there when it doesn't. That's the primary concern that we have.
Is this in the nature of a pressure release valve or a simpler machine?
Yes, sir. Exactly. And rather than run the risk of harming the employees, the downstream pollution control equipment, or the inside of the kiln, HCS put this vent on there.
Now this is monitored all the time it's in operation?
It's monitored when it's open.
Rotary kiln incinerator.
Yes, sir. It's
monitored. Operation is monitored.
Yes, sir. For things like pressure, heat.
And so when that heat control opens, then does this become an emergency situation?
Well, HCS describes it as an emergency. Frankly, we don't believe it's an emergency because it's something that HCS has sought and received permission to do. It's not in the nature of an emergency like a plane crashing into the facility. They have specifically requested the state's approval to be able to operate this heat surge vent.
This would be released into the atmosphere rather than into some other type of container?
Yes, sir, directly to the atmosphere, not to any secondary combustion chamber to finish burning, not through any pollution control equipment, directly to the atmosphere.
There is evidence that this will only happen in emergencies, which will be fairly unlikely.
Well, there's evidence that it probably won't happen very often. Whether that constitutes an emergency is obviously a matter of dispute. The conditions under which it can occur are carefully spelled out.
Is the frequency with which this might happen a factor to be taken into consideration by the agency in deciding the likelihood of or the effects of the discharge if it does happen?
No, sir, we don't believe it is, because what we know is when it opens, there will be uncontrolled emissions coming out of it.
So if it only happens once in 100 years, you still have to treat this like you treat the main stack?
Yes. If it's open, the evidence is it can emit emissions for 30 minutes. That's the entire period of concern for acute health effects. And we believe that frequency is no substitute for duration and concentration.
Is this the only technical objection that the opponents have to
Well, it's perhaps the only technical objection that basically the only one we brought before this court. We believe that our brief adequately addresses the law on this issue regarding the fact that an agency is bound to follow its rules. We think that this court's opinions, previous opinions, are clear on that. We also think that the Court of Appeals, at least up until 1982, agreed with that. In First Federal Savings and Loan Association versus Vandegrift, Justice Powers' last opinion on the issue of legislative rules, he agreed that an agency was bound to follow its own rules as well. We assert that that's the law in Texas, that it should remain the law, and that the Commission failed to follow that law in this case.
Any other questions?
May it please the Court, my name is Kathy Sist. I'm representing Harris County in this matter, and as Mr. Ryan indicated, I'll be addressing to the Court. The trial court's denial of the Texas Water Commission's amended answer in this proceeding, which essentially confessed error on most of the issues raised by the parties appealing the grant of the permit.
Are you still pursuing the denial of the legislative continuance?
I am not. Mr. Ryan, I believe it is. Yes. I am representing, I'm addressing the court simply on the denial of the amended motion, which confessed error on the substantive points raised by the parties. And as we see it, there are essentially two issues.
If the trial court comes to a judgment goes up on appeal, should the appellate court pay any attention to the judges writing the appellate court saying, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have ruled this way? Should the appellate court on review give some sort of weight to a trial court confessing error?
I believe that the appellate court might have that discretion to give some weight to a judge's saying that they committed a mistake. Certainly a party may confess error in front of an appellate court, and they are entitled to take that into account. So the question before you is whether the trial court abused its discretion, first of all, in not allowing the amended answer confessing error. And then the second issue, as I see it, is the effect of the agency's confession of error.
Procedurally, what action are you arguing that the trial court should have taken? Remanding it to the commission at that time?
No, sir. What I am arguing is that the court should have taken into account at that point the agency's confession of error. And then that would have kicked in the standard enunciated by the third court under
This was after argument had been completed that should reopen the case at that point in time?
No, it should have just simply considered the confession of error as the court was considering its judgment in the case. Wouldn't reopen
without
the
any,
case
without
for...
Without any rebuttal from the other side?
That's correct.
Without any opportunity to argue?
That's correct. And the reason that that isn't prejudicial in situations like this is because this is a substantial evidence appeal. The appeal is on the record. The parties don't argue evidence. They don't present evidence. The evidence is the record established at the agency.
What was the appropriate procedure for the trial court at that time? Had they allowed this?
The appropriate procedure, Your Honor, would have been for the trial court to allow the amendment and then to take into account the standard enunciated by the third court in Flores, and that standard is simply that, while not determinative on the issue, the agency's confession of error creates a presumption that the agency's order was invalid, and then they keep that standard in mind in evaluating the case.
The court had concluded that under these circumstances, the agency's order was invalid, with the appropriate procedure then to remand it back to the agency
for consideration? I'm sorry, Your Honor. Once the court makes a determination that the agency order is invalid to remand it at that point, that is an appropriate course of action for the court, yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May it please the court, Mr. Peter Ferraro and Mr. Robert Morris will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Ferraro will open with the first 13 minutes.
You've accepted grid on 18 points of error. There's really four issues here. There's the heat surge vent, there's the amendment, there's the financial assurance issue, and there's the legislative continuance issue. Now those 18 points of error all fit in there somewhere. I'm going to talk about the heat surge vent issue. I'm going to talk about the amendment issue.
I want to talk first about the heat surge vent.
And there, this outline is contained in, the, in our material that we gave you, if you want to refer to it in there. But really, what we have here, this is a system, and I'm going to give just a short explanation of the system. You really don't have to be able to read the words in here, but they're in the paper. What happens is a drum of waste is on a waste feed and gets put into the rotary kiln, which incinerates it. Pulled through the system, additional incineration goes through here, then it goes through the scrubbers, comes out again. What you have right here is a heat source vent. Notice there's a very important thing right here, and that's the top of it, and it's closed. Now, HCS did not design this unit. You can see from the record that this comes, this is an off-the-shelf unit, and it comes with the kiln. And this drawing is also in New Jersey. It comes with the kiln. And what it's designed for is when the pressure builds up in here and it needs a release, you don't want it released on the workers and you don't want it destroying equipment. And so it burps and releases it out here.
Is it possible?
Yes,
sir. Is it possible or is there a design of this particular piece of equipment that would release it into some other type of container so that it's not released directly into the atmosphere?
No, Your Honor, but let me tell you, that's a good question. This design does release into the atmosphere, but what's important here is what it releases into the atmosphere. Now, they're telling you nobody considered what was released into the atmosphere. That's not true. These quotes are also there. This is Jimmy Ring. He is not HCS's engineer. This man is the engineer for the Texas Air Control Board. And the Air Control Board had responsibility for the air emissions. What Jimmy Rand testified to concerning the heat surge vent, why did he not consider it a heat surge vent source for your general permit review? He said, because my understanding of the application, the bypass tax, which he's referring to, would be used in the case of an emergency type situation, which would automatically trigger the waste feed cutoff. In other words, the waste, this stops. You see? That stops. And what that does is there's no more waste going in there. Air's still coming through. There's no more waste going in here. And
it just lets out what has already passed that point.
Exactly. And what happens to the stuff that's past that point? In order for this to open, you have to have two other redundant failures. Now, picture a complete separate system starting here behind this one. Because there are two systems from here back, two separate systems. So there's a redundant system. In addition, there are fans that operate electrically and from steam that keep pulling the matters through the system. Also, the scrubbers keep working because there are redundant systems on the scrubbers. One's diesel, one's electric. So if, for instance, if the power goes out, the system goes out, the waste feed cuts off, the steam fan pulls everything through. There's nothing in here. The steam fan pulls it through. There's nothing new going in there. The steam fan pulls through what was in there, and the diesel works the scrubber.
But the way you have described it, Counsel, the redundant system is behind the, is after the heat fan.
There's a redundant system on each one.
Yes,
but
your redundant system, to use the drawing over on the other side, is beyond, in the system, beyond the heat surge vent.
Right. And
so, right, prior to the heat surge vent, there's no redundant system.
Right. And what happens is that these have to fail before the heat surge vent can even open. So when you have, for instance, if the lights go out, the waste feed stops. There's no waste going in, and the system can
keep running. Well, what you're saying is there's less likelihood of the use of the heat system, but still, when it does go, doesn't this discharge all these things into the atmosphere?
Exactly. Could it discharge things into the atmosphere? You have to understand how that system works to get to the next quote from the engineer from the Air Control Board, who did consider what would go in the atmosphere. And they asked, why wasn't a disaster review included in this application? Which is what you're looking for. What would, why wouldn't they figure out what was coming out of it? And what he said was, remember, this is not our engineering, it's Air Control Board engineering, because none of the compounds that we have triggered for that type of review were present anywhere near the concentration or quantity that would justify a review. And the reason that's true is because of the redundant system. Now, there may be a little mistake here. The redundant system is not only
the fact that the redundant system doesn't affect what's in there, does it?
Yes, it pulls it through.
Well,
the fans continue to pull it through. And there's nothing going in anymore.
The first question was, did you examine this or consider this? And they said, no, we didn't consider it. Then he said, we
didn't.
You had two quotes. First quote.
The first quote was the general permit review. They didn't consider it as an emission source.
Did not consider it as an emission source permit in the permit review because it's considered an emergency situation and not a regular emission. The second question is, why didn't you consider it? I mean, because there's going to be an emission. They said, because none of the particulate or whatever we're worried about, none of the contaminants would be there in that quantity.
Exactly what they said.
At that point,
yeah.
Why do you need the rest of the system then?
And they said it. Well, because you have to remember, Judge, Your Honor, that while you need the additional redundancy keeps the whole system working.
I understand the
and
redundancy,
there's no way
but if it's already refined at that point, to the point that you're not concerned about the quantity of contaminants.
But there's no more waste.
Why do we have six more stages?
Because the waste feed is cut off. You have those because in the regular, when it's regularly operating, you still have waste going into the kiln.
But I thought we're concerned with the waste coming out, not the waste coming
in. Yeah, but if nothing comes out unless it goes in. And the first thing that happens...
And there's nothing in there.
The first thing that happens in an upset situation is the waste feed cuts off.
And so there's nothing, it's empty.
Whatever's burned in there is filling there. The last drum that went in will burn. But what happens is the waste feed cuts off. And then everything else keeps working. So the vent won't open. Only if the fans and scrubbers fail, then the vent will open.
You say this is an off-the-shelf system?
This is an off-the-shelf system.
And I presume
this is a kiln.
I presume it's been utilized elsewhere. There's some experience with it.
There's some experience with it. Even the plant.
Is there evidence as to what the experience has been with this use as far as
that? The plaintiff's own expert, and I have to cite in my notes, testified they have never heard of this opening. Ever. And as a practical matter, he also said that he didn't just stop there. Jimmy Randall said, what I said was that the quantity and concentration of chemicals involved were not high enough to justify a disaster. This thing burps, lets the heat out, protects the workers, and just the safest device is all. Now the other issue, and frankly, you don't have what you thought you had here. This is not an emissions. This is a source. And this is something that didn't even require, based on their own engineers, the engineers, didn't even require looking at what came out of it, because nothing was in there.
But you're saying there. That when it lets the heat out, it doesn't let out any contaminants?
By that time, there's no contaminants. The contaminants are so limited in there that it won't let any out that would merit a disaster review. That's what the evidence says. That's what the other mom saying. That's what the expert, the Air Quality Control Board expert says.
But the graph shows the heat vent being up there at the rotary kiln incinerator. And that's what we're talking about.
There's no doubt, there's no doubt, Judge, that that's where it's at. But what happens?
And when it burps, it just lets out heat.
It lets out what's left in there. And what's left in there by that time, because there's no waste feed going in, there's no waste in there, what it lets out, what it burps out there, isn't enough by the Air Control Board's own engineer testimony. The evidence that they present isn't enough to even merit a disaster review because the chemicals and compounds left in there, it's not going to totally, it may burp out just hot air, but it'll probably burp out gases, but the quantity and quality of those gases don't even merit a disaster review of any kind.
What was the basis for the agency's confession of error? Was there a response at that point that we should have reviewed this and did not?
Let's look at the agency's confession of error. That's in your... This is what Judge Williams got in her hand. 9 days after the hearing, and attempted to, and they wanted to file. And what it said was, by the way, the commission is not here. This is their appeal, and they are not here. This is their issue. They're the ones who asked for it. They're not in front of them. Yeah. What they asked for was, they wanted this court to reverse the order and render a decision denying the application. Now, Mary Pearl Williams got that on her desk, and she looked at that. And so what do you do at that point in time? You use, if you look at the face of the document, you use your discretion to determine what it was that you had. Now, she looks at this document and sees, one, first of all, I can't grant that. I can't render a decision denying the application. Two, the commission can't even ask me to do that. They don't have the jurisdiction or power. Once that permitting is done...
What was the basis for the confession
right
there? I'm not asking you what they wanted done.
Everything that was could possibly be listed, it was all listed in numbers. It was just a mass list of all the complaints of the Smiths. And so...
On what issues?
All the issues. Every issue. There were 454 issues submitted to the Court of Appeals. This essentially covered every one of those issues.
What do you attribute this change of heart?
Well, Judge, I don't know. Because in order to change heart, they have to have open meetings. They have to follow their own rules and regulations and procedures. And it is not evident on this that they did that. Nor is it evident on this that what they were asking for could even be granted. The court couldn't give it. They couldn't even do it themselves. And there's no reason why they're asking for it. I don't know. But she got a piece of paper signed by an attorney general that doesn't give any of these. So, and also, this is just a simple abuse of discretion. This isn't something, you're not protecting the environment here. What you have is that the commission still has the ability to amend the permit. They still have the ability to act in emergency if there's a problem. And they still have the ability to monitor what's going on down there at HCS. They control. They protect the public. What you have here is just a simple attempt to amend a petition which reshapes the case. Totally. It reshapes the case. It says, everything we've done, we want to undo. And they can't do that by this method. They cannot do this by this method. So she did what was reasonable and sent it back. It's one point I want to make. You don't have what you thought you had here on any issue. I'll give you an example. The legislative continuance. You think that the issue before you is whether a legislative continuance can apply to an administrative proceeding. That's not the case.
The legislator in this case
is Mike Jackson. And here is why he came to the hearing. I formally request to be given party status with the proceedings, not because I own property in Shore Acres, or because I'm a businessman. No justiciable interest. He only wanted it because he intended to be the District 129 state representative. That's why he was there. So you think you have the issue of legislative continuance when you don't even have a lawyer representing the party, nor do you have a party, a true party, in the case. You don't even get that far. You don't even have a true party to the case. You have someone that just wanted to show up to see what's going on in his district. That's the job of the legislature, but that's not a reason to grant a continuance or to even ask for one. Although, as a matter of accommodation, HCS really didn't care if he showed up to know what was going on. We wanted him to show up to know what was going on in his district.
He wasn't representative at that point.
No, he wasn't even elected at that point. He hoped to be elected at this point when he made this quote, and eventually he was elected. But he never offered a brief, never offered evidence on sort of.
Was there, after he was elected, was there a request?
For legislative continuance?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, the court was granted, and I think maybe at other times there was. But in any event, the real issue is he didn't meet the first two requirements of legislative continuance. There'd have to be a lawyer representing a party or a party. He's sitting there. You know, what you have is, in this case, you don't have the facts, and you don't, and we're not afraid of the merits in this case. We think this writ should be sent back improvidently granted, because we don't think you have what you thought you had when you got here, and for a number of reasons. But we fought the merits in this case. In 86, when we first filed this, I didn't have a gray hair on my head, I didn't need cheaters, and I was an inch taller. Okay? We're not afraid of the merits. But if there was ever a case where writ improvidently granted was consigned to dispose of, this is it.
Thank you. Any other questions?
May it please the Court, I'm Robin Morris from Houston. I've been asked to address the issue of financial assurance as well as the legislative continuance. First of all, on the financial assurance issue, I would point out to the Court that both Harris County and the Smiths continue to cite the Court to the wrong statute as far as relating to financial assurance. Since the HCS application was filed in August of 1986, it was grandfathered, and this is in the session laws of the 1987 session laws, from the provisions that are being cited in briefs, even the amended brief filed earlier this week by Harris County. The actual law that was applicable to this situation as far as financial assurance was adopted earlier in the 80s, and it made financial assurance generally discretionary with the agency for processing type facilities. And incinerators are processing type facilities as opposed to a disposal facility, which under the Solid Waste Act is defined as a facility that puts waste in the ground or on top of the ground. It was entirely discretionary, with the only mandatory requirement at the time being that they meet the minimum EPA requirements for hazardous waste if the facility was going to manage hazardous waste. What the Texas Water Commission did was they exercised that discretion and they imposed financial assurance requirements for closure of the facility as well as liability coverage. And this is notably consistent with the EPA program which they were administering at the time. In fact, under federal law, the state to administer that program, and our state law as well, says that the state is supposed to administer the federal program. The federal law requires it to be equivalent. Contrary to what the county has argued in their brief, anyway, there is no provision in the law at the time, or even in the 1990 law, or 87 law, for operational financing. That wasn't added until 1991 after this permit was issued. Secondly, as far as the point made by Mr. Ryan, as far as the amount of liability coverage, that was dealt through prior rulemaking. EPA itself first considered whether to set liability coverage on a case-by-case basis, and in April of 1982 rejected that approach and set a standard of $1 million per occurrence, $2 million in the aggregate. Not surprisingly, the state, through the TWC, adopted that standard. And what happened in this case is that the agency, as it had been doing, all other applications, merely plugged in that amount. So there was nothing to adjudicate. This court, in the case of Railroad Commission versus Lone Star Gas, pointed out that generally it's in the informed discretion of an agency to set regulatory requirements either through ad hoc adjudication or through prior rulemaking, with a preference for prior rulemaking and the public input that that entails. Here, the TWC followed that preferred approach, set the standard in accordance with the EPA program that it was administering. Therefore, there was nothing to adjudicate as far as the amount of liability coverage. It was a set figure. Since there was nothing to adjudicate, there was not a required fact-finding, and therefore the argument about no substantial evidence is misplaced. We submit that the record does have evidence of the TWC permit engineer about considering financial assurance, but what we're basically telling the court is that that was not a required fact-finding and there was no requirement for substantial evidence. On legislative continuance, I'll just say this. This was an APA proceeding, not a Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code proceeding. And by the plain language of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, that statute on legislative continuance only applies to suits in courts in Monsanto versus Cornerstone Mud, decided this by this court last year. Do you apply the plain meaning language or rule to the language of the statute? And it does not say administrative proceedings. The APA itself has never had a legislative continuance provision in it. It's been amended many times. It was recodified in 1993 into the government code. And that's in the face of longstanding attorney general opinions, first in 1949 and 1973, that the legislative continuance provision did not apply to state administrative agencies.
We think... Any questions?
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Anything? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to address the financial assurance issue briefly. Frankly, this morning is the first time that HCS has ever suggested the proposition that earlier law applied on the issue of financial assurance, and we'd be glad to address that issue in a post-submission brief if the court would like.
It's the first time they've suggested that the earlier statute applied?
Yes.
It's in their brief.
Well, their brief suggests, I think, that the 1990 statute applies, and I'm suggesting that it's the 1986 statute. I would also suggest that there's a section of the rule that Mr. Morris referred to, which is discussed at page 11 of the Court of Appeals opinion, subsection D, which we believe is further support for the contention that the initial insurance amount established by the agency must be adjusted upward from the minimums, if necessary, based on the risk associated with the facility. And again, the only evidence in the record about risk associated with this facility is that at least $5 to $10 million in insurance is necessary. Briefly on the heat surge vent, this rotary kiln incinerator is 12 feet in diameter and 50 feet long. It's permitted to accept thousands of pounds of waste per hour. There will be a lot of waste in there at the time the waste feed cutoff is activated. That's clear in the record.
Given the likelihood of the vent opening is a factor. If it, I know your position is it's not. If it is, do you lose?
Yes. If the frequency of its opening, well, let me back up. If the likelihood of it opening, I'm not sure that we lose, because I think the record's clear that it's likely it will open. The record says it's likely it will not happen very often.
So the frequency
yeah,
is...
Yeah, if you determine that you can substitute frequency for duration and concentration of air contaminants in the Clean Air Act definition, we lose.
Yeah, did the two-year expert testify that with similar products they did not know any time it had opened?
No, I believe they testified that they had never been there when it opened. They had never been at a facility when one opened. However, the record also shows that nobody knows of a heat surge vent like this put at the downstream end of a primary combustion chamber, like this rotary kiln. They always go at least after the secondary combustion chamber, so that even if you don't have the benefit of the pollution control equipment, you at least have the benefit of having the waste completely combusted before you emit this material directly to the atmosphere.
Is this an off-the-shelf product such as Mr. Farrar described?
It's based on a design that was originally prepared for another facility. Off-the-shelf is taking it too far. I don't think there are 10 of these in the world.
My question is basically, are there other units that are substantially similar to this in use, and is there a historical record of how often these heat vents have been activated?
The record doesn't indicate that there is one in use anywhere that has a heat surge vent on the rotary kiln that's used for a primary combustion. So there's no evidence about how often it would open in that situation.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments for this morning's causes, and they are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the
court. Y'all please rise. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.